Well, greetings. Welcome to The Dividing Line. It's a Wednesday. We're doing the program a day early for the obvious reason that tomorrow and Friday is ReformCon here in the Phoenix area. Picked the perfect week. I actually saw my son post a something on Facebook from his weather app. Let me look here. Oh, man, it's back down. Break the jackets out. Only talking 117 on Saturday. He had posted one that had 118. Tomorrow 109, Friday 115, Saturday 117, Sunday 115, 113, 108. Yeah, that's Phoenix. That's June. Yep. Now, it's dry as a bone. Of course, Brother Callahan would call me right as I'm starting the dividing line, so I can't talk to him right now. But anyway, I already did. I moved it. It's right where it needs to be. So we've got ReformCon. And so I'm going to be busy Thursday and Friday, so we're sneaking it in early. Just saw something posted a little while ago that it looks like cease, desist. Thank you. Why are you still doing that? You know, I thought when you hit the button, it's supposed to stop shaking, but it's just buzzing away there, finally stopped. And then I put it down, buzzed again, just sort of like, I can do this all I want. They have a mind of their own. They're a little bit scary, these voluntary digital devices that undoubtedly will become part of the New World Order or something. I don't know. The live stream is going to be made available to everybody for free. So all I saw was Jeff said, we've found a way to make this work, and I don't know what it is. Didn't have a chance to look at it. So, what?
You know, I said that before too.
we found a way to make it work. Didn't really work out too well, did it? I would imagine he's sort of busy right now with all this stuff going on. We've got folks flying in from all over the place, and hit the button twice to totally silence your iPhone. Okay, all right. Well, I only hit it once. I've got one of those apps that tells me who's calling and stuff, and I think it messes stuff up. But anyway, so that's why we're doing the program early today. I want to get into some Muslim apologetics today. I listened this morning. I'm going to go ahead and do it this way, because I was going to write something out, and writing takes a long time. Unless you use emojis to translate the King James Bible. Did you see that? Oh, yeah. Yep. There is a new King James Emoji Bible. Yep. I think I saw it either this morning or yesterday morning. It started this morning. Al Mohler tweeted something about, dear millennials, no, not emojis. So, you know, obviously, Dr. Mohler's, you know, in the same camp that I am. I'm a terrible, horrible, nasty old man, and I'm out of touch because I sort of sit back and go, you know, emojis, huh? Most studies are now saying that millennials, on average, do not read a single book per year. And now you have an emoji Bible. There's this thing about growing up. You know, there's just scary, very scary. Huh? The selfie Bible? I don't know. Okay, I'm about to ban someone from Twitter. Need a bit of powder on your head.
Oh, yeah. Well, I've told you that before.
Oh, yeah. Like, I'm going to do that. Like, I don't care, Jonathan.
He gets shiny, but he...
Yeah, anyway, anyhow, hey, we can just turn these things off. We did it for years and years, and if people want me to start wearing makeup and stuff like that, we can turn it off and do something else. Trust me. I mean, I'm 99.9% serious about that. I don't have the foggiest interest in worrying about dressing up or putting on makeup or anything else like that. Just not going to happen, not in this life. Anyway, that distracted me from something else that was actually interesting. And now I've lost it. It's gone. This morning I listened to, I linked this. In fact, I'm pretty sure I did, either on Twitter or Facebook or both. I don't remember. Jonathan McClatchy has been doing this, webinar stuff. On Saturdays, they had asked me to do something, I think back in March or something, I wasn't able to do it. I've actually got an email from him that I need to respond to about maybe something in November. It's just really hard for me to schedule stuff that far down the road. Anyway, this past Saturday, Michael Brown joined the webinar and did a wonderful presentation, about 45, 50 minutes, on basically the framework of a meaningful understanding of messianic prophecy, prophecies of the Messiah and issues. And, you know, he knows the Jewish rabbis and the traditions so well. And it's really, really interesting to listen to someone who really has a solid handle on that stuff. And if you've not seen his five volume Answers to Jewish Objections to Jesus, then you need to get hold of it, and it'd be an awesome addition to your library. But after that, this is the same webinar where a few weeks ago, maybe a month or so ago, Yusuf Ismail was on talking about Muhammad in the Bible. Now, Muslims have to find Muhammad in the Bible. They don't have a choice. The Quran says that Muhammad is in the Torah and the Injil. It's in the Bible. And so they've got to find him. Now, I don't know of a single, you know, it's funny, my Muslim friends love to quote critical scholars. I don't know of a single critical scholar in the world that believes that Muhammad is in the Bible. Now, that includes critical scholars that believe in such thing as prophecy. The more my Muslim friends try to find Muhammad in the Bible, the more they utterly destroy any foundation they might try to build to create a consistent methodology of doing theology positively within Islam and then doing apologetics to Christianity. Now, one of my chief concerns is that I can count on one hand with a few fingers left over the number of Muslim apologists that care about that, that care that they self-consciously cannot produce a consistent theology and apologetic that does not use double standards. They're just so few. Just so few. And so Yusuf Ismail was on this webinar, and there was this long, you know, Yusuf didn't exactly go, he didn't go the Ahmed Didot direction, which I sort of wondered, given his relationship with IPCI. Exactly what that means. But anyway, the big thing recently has been Isaiah 42. In fact, I even bought a little Kindle book recently and recorded it. I'm so thankful, by the way, for those of you who do recordings off your Kindle, like I've taught people how to do. I found a new dongle, and I discovered that for like 3.5 years, I would have these times where the reading would become really staticky and almost, well, at times impossible to understand, and then it would slowly recover. Had nothing to do with my Kindle or my computer. It was the dongle. and I ordered a new one, and sound quality, everything, 1,000% improved. No more of those problems. Get a decent dongle. Don't get the super cheap little ones. Get one with like some volume controls on it. Something that has some substance to it. It really helps. But I recorded this book from a Muslim scholar, and it's all on how there's absolutely no question. I can guarantee you Yusuf Ismail's read this book. No question that Isaiah 42 is about Muhammad. And listening to this stuff, just, you know, I'm just going to be perfectly honest with everybody. It fundamentally convinces me of the bankruptcy of Islamic apologetics as a whole, that people would be willing to go this far. At least, you know, I know one Muslim, I'm not going to name him just because I don't want to get him in trouble, but I know one Muslim that says, hey, you know, the Quran says it, so I believe it, but it doesn't tell me where. It doesn't tell me what text, so I'm not wedded to any one of them. And I can just honestly say, I don't know which ones specifically refer. Now, I've got a problem with that because it seems to me that this is such a central issue for Muhammad in the Quran that we do know, there's really no question about the fact that we do know the state of the text in the days of Muhammad. And so if Muhammad's idea was, hey, it's right here, it's right in your scriptures, here I am, then we should be able to find that today. The fact of the matter is we cannot. The abuse of John 14 and 16, and it is an abuse of John 14 and 16, Deuteronomy 18, Isaiah 42, just really is a major, major problem for the Muslim who really wants to be consistent in the defense of his faith. Unfortunately, a lot of Muslims are not concerned about that. Anyway, so Michael gives his presentation, and Sam Shamoon comes on and asks some questions, and some other people come on, and then Yusuf Ismail comes on. Now, it was fascinating to listen to the exchange, the sort of mini debate between Yusuf Ismail and Michael Brown. Now, obviously, I know Yusuf a whole lot better than Michael does. But it is interesting to listen to two men that you know pretty well. Obviously, I know Michael far better than I know Yusuf. Engaging. And, you know, Michael and I have our different strengths. And messianic prophecy is in his wheelhouse. I mean, I wouldn't go there. That's not my... I read Michael's books for that. So this is right down his alley, and there were a couple times where you could just tell, you know, Michael is a really nice guy, and he keeps going, well, I want to be respectful here. I don't want to express disdain here, but the questions you're asking are just inane. I mean, he's really struggling to not say, Yusuf, you've got to be kidding me. What do you not hear what you're saying? Which all of us who've dealt with Yusuf Ismail want to say that repeatedly, over and over again. I mean, remember when I played Daniel Wallace's rather strong, thorough refutation of Yusuf Ismail's comments from our debate in the mosque in Durban? That has not impacted Yusuf Ismail. He's still repeating the same stuff and still thinks he's right. So the author of the book, I mean, I corrected him. Then the author of the book he was quoting corrected him. But what do they know? Yusuf doesn't even read Greek. And yet, you know, so we've all had the really strong temptation at times to go, seriously? I mean, wow. Anyway, at one point, though, I just, started to lose it a little bit. Because Yusuf tends to just wander all over the landscape when it comes to topics. And you refute him on one thing and he just moves off to something else like you never even mentioned it. And next time you debate him, he'll bring up the exact same thing you refuted him on the last time, which is very troubling. It really is when you think about it. Well, here came this standard Muslim objection. Now, we all need to be prepared for this. And I don't have it queued up right now. I'm just going off what I listened to this morning. All of us need to be ready for this because it is a standard Muslim objection. And that is, well, you know, but Jesus said in Matthew chapter 10, I'm only sent to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Now, everyone listening to this program, how many times over the past 10 years in listening to Muslim after Muslim after Muslim, have we just sat back and said, well, wait a minute. Wait. How can you honestly and fairly quote Matthew chapter 10 and come to the conclusion that it was Matthew's intention to actually communicate to you the idea that from Matthew's viewpoint, Jesus was only the Messiah for the Jews? Given that, not only are there all sorts of other indications in the same sections of Matthew about the gospel going to the Gentiles, but the end of the book specifically has Jesus sending his disciples into all the world. It is dishonest if you know that Matthew 28 is there. Now, I understand that there are some Muslims that will, you know, they'll read something in that and go, and I heard there's some question about the originality of the end of Matthew. Now, none of them ever check it out. There is no doubt about the originality of the end of Matthew. There is, you know, I might as well just simply say, well, you know, there is doubt about the originality of Surah 112, Surah Al-Ikhlas. We don't know that Muhammad ever actually quoted that. I mean, it's just really easy to make up this stuff and just go to the skeptical thing and say, well, we don't have a video of him actually giving it originally. I mean, you can go into hyper-skepticism all you want, but the fact of the matter is, there is not a shred of anything but pure theory based upon theological speculation about Matthew 28 not being a part of the original Gospel of Matthew. Nothing. It's pure speculation intended to defend whatever heresy someone doesn't like what's in Matthew 28 to talk about. So here's Yusuf. Now, Yusuf is not an ignorant Muslim. I mean, most Christians are ignorant about Islam, and most Muslims are ignorant about Christianity. Okay? That's just a fact. Our communities don't do real well in talking to one another. And let me make a simple statement here that Yahya Snow undoubtedly will rip out of context and turn into a video, because that's what he does. That's all he does. Off the top of my head, I can't remember a time when Yahya has actually made one of these videos that was actually dealing with the substance of what I was saying. That's a commentary in and of itself. But anyway, when I listen to debates, I'm going to play a section of a debate that took place in Melbourne. Great debate. Appreciate the attitude of both the men that participated in it. But I'm making an observation here. It seems to me that your best Christian debaters show significantly more concern about having in-depth and accurate knowledge of Islam than your best Muslim debaters show of having an accurate and in-depth knowledge of Christianity. I stand by that as an observation. And I think it's absolutely true. It's absolutely true. I think we'll see that, like I said, in this debate here in a moment. Anyway, Yusuf Ismail is not an ignorant Muslim. He's not your standard Muslim. He engages in dawah. This is what he does. He reads lots and lots of books. He communicates with Shabir Ali, and they share a lot of stuff together and all the rest of this kind of stuff. So how many times has Yusuf Ismail been corrected in this abusive misrepresentation of the New Testament and specifically the Gospel of Matthew? Over and over and over again. So how on earth can you keep repeating the same thing over and over again? And when Michael heard it, see, Michael doesn't have that background with Yusuf. When Michael heard it, he's like, I'm pretty shocked you'd say something like that. Because every Muslim needs to understand the chronological order in which things are found in the Quran because of abrogation and stuff like that. So why wouldn't you notice that Matthew 10 is about one particular period of time during the ministry of Jesus, but it's not the entirety of the ministry of Jesus. And after that time period, in light of events in the ministry of Christ, Jesus sends his disciples to all the nations. So Michael goes, inconsistency, double standard, hypocrisy. And he's right. He's smack dab right. And we have pointed this out over and over and over and over and over again to the Muslim who doesn't engage with Christians. We simply have to be ready to point it out again and be patient in the process, because we cannot know where they have or have not ever truly had knowledge given to them of this issue. But that's not the case with Yusuf Ismail. He well knows. He well knows that that is an abuse of the text. And he just keeps doing it over and over again. What do you do with someone who will not be corrected? No matter how clear the refutation, no matter how overwhelming the documentation, just keep saying it again and again and again and again. What do you do? And when Michael dismantled his argument, and he did, I mean, it was a thorough, logical, complete refutation. There was no recovering from it. I'm sitting there going, I wonder what the response is going to be. How's Yusuf going to bail himself out of this one? It was a standard Ismail move. Go back to a different topic. Go back to Isaiah 42. Just completely abandon any defense of what you just said. Just let it slide. And here's the problem. He'll do it again. With somebody else, somebody he thinks he can get away with it, he'll go back to Matthew chapter 10. He'll repeat it again. Despite the fact that multiple people with hundreds of times more knowledge in the New Testament than he has have thoroughly refuted him on the subject, he'll keep repeating. What do you do in a situation like that? What do you do in a situation like that? So I was going to write something up on it and say, so very frustrating to see this kind of thing. But decide, you know what, let's just throw it out there, because I'm going to be looking at this debate. And, you know, when I look at, I've not met this particular Muslim that is engaging in this debate. And he himself says he's not really big on debates and doesn't like the terminology and doesn't want to offend anybody. I appreciate all of that. Still, my hope is that even as I address some of the common misunderstandings that he repeats, my hope is he would be the type of person who would listen and consider and go, you know what? I won't do that again in the future. And I mentioned there was a Muslim apologist talked to me in London and said, you know, half of the arguments I used to use against Christians, I can't use anymore because of you. Great. That's someone who's listening. Sadly, not everybody listens. Not everybody listens. And Yusuf Ismail once again gave us evidence in the webinar. I didn't listen. And evidently, I guess things got pretty nasty in the chat in the side window. Even Michael stopped and made comment about, oh, come on, this is getting very insulting. And so I would almost like to read it if I could find it. I'm not sure if anybody saved it or if it's even possible to save those things. I'm not sure how the webinar works. I'm not sure what software they're using, blah, 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 blah. But a couple of times, Michael actually did respond to Yusuf, who was texting things. And so I'm sure he was involved in whatever the encounter going on was. That'd be extremely distracting. I mean, I've sort of gotten used to sort of glancing over, seeing Twitter, seeing the channel, stuff like that. But I don't watch the YouTube chat that goes on with the YouTube channel. You do that. I don't find it interesting. Anyway, well, I still don't even have it up. I'm not even sure that it would work overly well on this side. Too many things to be looking at. If you think I'm distracted now, look what happened there. Okay, do you have the video here? We're just gonna sort of hop skip around a little bit and make some comments. But like I said on Facebook or Twitter, one of the two, I said this was an excellent presentation by the Christian side, the professor from Melbourne, who I do not know and have not met, and maybe someday I will, because he teaches Arabic. He's an obviously very sharp guy. But what we need to recognize is he's responding to what would probably be the majority view of Muslims, and that is the Quran has never been changed, that it is word for word identical. Now, Yusuf Ismail has admitted that's not the case. Adnan Rashid had to admit that that was not the case in our debate in London. And he did again. I was thinking about the first debate in London, and then he did again a few weeks ago. Yeah, that doesn't change the meaning. You know, there's just a few little things like here, that, and there. Okay. So the thesis was, has the Quran been changed? We Christians have to be extremely careful how we answer that question. I realize the other side, 99% of the time, is not going to care whether we're being accurate or not. You should do this because it is relevant to your God. It is relevant to your service to Christ. It is relevant to being consistent and seeking to be his servant. You shouldn't do it because of numbers or how often you get treated in the same way or things like that. If you fall into that trap, you're going to be in trouble. I realize that what I'm saying is going to put you at a disadvantage in many conversations. And there are people who would say, Nat, just don't even bother. Just go ahead and go for it. Use a double standard. I can't tell you to do that. It's not an option for a Christian. It just isn't an option. But the reality is that when we say, has the Quran been changed? If we ask the question, has the New Testament been changed? We have to define our terms. Are there textual variants in the manuscripts of both the New Testament and the Quran? Of course, there are in every handwritten document ever produced by mankind, especially any document that has been widely copied by hand over a period, especially of literally centuries. No document ever made does not have those variations. Now, are there Christians that are ignorant of that? Of course there are. Are there Muslims that are ignorant more evidently than Christians. And at the beginning here, you're going to see some claims from Muslims, modern Muslims, that the only parallel I can come up with for these claims are the King James only guys. They are that disconnected from the reality of the history of the text of the Quran. So I would have to make it the lower level of Islamic da'wah is what is being addressed here, which unfortunately represents the majority viewpoint of the Muslim people, which would mean that there's a whole lot of education needs to go on to have a proper and accurate understanding of these facts, these issues. All right. So let's jump in here. I keep talking about it, and we're halfway through the program. And
Quran and its transmission. And let's be clear about what the focus of this is. It's the claim that the words that come from the lips of Muhammad from 610 to 632 AD are exactly identical with the words that is found in the Qurans that we have today. What we're not talking about is English translations of the Quran. There's about 106 of those, but we're only focusing on the Arabic. So you're going to learn some.
Well, that's interesting. 106 English translations of the Quran. How many times do you have Muslims who will say, well, you got the NIV and you got the New American Standard. Which one's the right one? You have 106 English translations of the Quran. Which one's the right one? Well, the Quran only exists in Arabic. Okay, then we need to look at the English and at the Greek and the Hebrew, right? Got to have the same standards, got to have the same arguments, so on and so forth. About 106. That's interesting.
Pick tonight from me. One of my other jobs is I teach Arabic. Many Muslims make incredible claims about the Quran. This is one from the Turkish billionaire, Fethullah Gulen. He says, the Quran's text is entirely reliable. It's not been altered, edited, or tampered with since it was revealed. All Muslims know only one Quran, perfectly preserved in all its original words. American writer Suzanne Hanif says, the Holy Quran is the only revealed scripture in the history of mankind that has been preserved from the present to the present time in its exact original form. Jamaluddin Zaragoza says, you can travel to any part of the world and pick up a copy of the Quran and you'll find it the same throughout the world. Abdullah Yusuf Aliya, a famous translator of the Quran, says, the Arabic text we have today...
Now this is interesting. Because, of course, Yusuf Ali, his translation is the most popular English translation, not because it has won that position by strength of translation or text or things like that, but primarily because it's been promoted by the Saudi government. So you get enough money behind something. That's sort of how it works. But I'm pretty certain that I have read notes from Yusuf Ali that discuss textual variants. So this is strange to me. But, you know, here's the quote.
Identical to the text that was revealed to the prophet. Not even a single letter has yielded to corruption. This book that comes out of Abu Dhabi and available in bookshops around Australia says the Quran has remained unchanged, even to a dot has not changed. No variation of the text can be found.
He's giving a lot of examples here. And I have encountered many a Muslim that held that this is what they believed. Obviously, it's not because they had researched it themselves, but this is what they had been taught. This is what they had read. They're trusting these sources. And they really believe that the Quran as it exists today, not even a... Now, and the problem is, there were no dots originally. So when it's to not, you know, even to a dot, the dots were inserted a century later. The diacriticals are a later addition to the text. So That doesn't even make any sense. But there are variations in razm, in the actual consonantal text in the Quran. There isn't any question about this. We have the manuscripts. We don't have the wealth of textual critical material that we have for the New Testament, for the Quran, by any stretch of the imagination. But we have sufficient manuscripts to demonstrate the variations that existed. And the early tafsir literature, the early commentary literature on the Quran, is filled with references to textual variants. Well, filled with. They weren't embarrassed to talk about it. It was a known fact, and it wasn't considered to be a huge admission or something to talk about these things. And so it's not even a questionable thing. I can put the thing, he's going to do the same thing, but put the stuff up on the screen. Here it is. Here's where something's been written in, and here's where something's been taken out, and here's where this has been edited here. And it happened in written documents. It doesn't mean that we can't come up with the original any longer, but it does mean that it will require study and diligence and fairness and some level of objectivity to utilize the materials that we do have to be able to come up with the original text. And if you believe stuff like this, you're not going to be really investing in the project of determining the original text, because you figure that what you've got right now is good enough. That's why King James Onlyists are not contributing to CSNTM or to textual critical projects dealing with the restoration of the original text and New Testament. The King James good enough for me. And if, well, the Uthmanic recension is good enough for me, is your attitude as a Muslim, well, there you go. Which is why a large portion of the push for a critical edition of the Quran doesn't come from the Islamic world. It comes outside the Islamic world. And the reason for that is because this kind of a perspective is the majority view. Which means the majority of Muslims who have thought about this subject are deceived on the history of their own text. Now, are there Christians who are completely ignorant about the history of their text too? Yep, sure are. But the reality is, if you go to a Christian bookstore, unless you're going to Peter Ruckman's bookstore or Gail Riblinger's bookstore, if you're going to a real Christian bookstore and you buy 5 books on the subject of history of the Bible, they're all going to tell you the same thing. They're all going to tell you that there are variations between those manuscripts. Now, how clearly they're going to express that and explain that depends on the book you get. Depends on the knowledge of the author. But the reality is, well, it's real simple. Why do I keep forgetting to bring an Arabic copy of the Quran here? I have one sitting in another room, but so we'll look at the study. Oh, I can't do that because the study Quran doesn't have it. Let's grab Yusuf Ali here. This is Ahmed Ali. Well, anyway, the point is you've got the Arabic text along the side. What you're not going to find down at the bottom of the page are any footnotes. Unlike if I grab a New American Standard or I grab a ESV, there are going to be footnotes. There are going to be side column notes. There are text notes that will not only say or and give an alternate translation, but some manuscripts say this, some manuscripts say that. And that different translations have more notes than others. The New King James has a lot of notes. But the reality is that Christians are upfront about this, and we put right into our Bibles, here's where variants are. Is that an exhaustive list? No, it's not an exhaustive list. I'm working on this project. Everybody knows now I'm working on this textual critical project, will be for years. And just in preparatory stuff, I mean, probably the next year is going to be almost all preparatory, just huge amounts of reading and stuff like that. But one of the things is also reading the primary manuscript I'm going to be focusing upon, becoming very intimately familiar with it. And I ran across something. I was chatting with, we've got some real geeks in our chat channel. We really do. We got one guy, Garrett, who took textual critical stuff from Wallace. And then we've got Alan Kirshner in there, Deo Valente, who is doing his PhD under one of the leading scholars in the field. And so I've got some guys in there that I can bounce stuff off of, and both of them have been very helpful in resources and bibliographies and all sorts of stuff like that. So we were chatting about something that I had just happened to run into while working with the text of the papyri. And that is that P45, my text, in Acts contains, we have Acts 13:48 in P45. And the key disputed term in Acts 13:48, tetagmenoi, P45 doesn't contain it. Not just in the sense that because it's fragmentary, it's in the missing part. No, the author of P45 did not include tetagmenoi. Now, will you find that in the side column of your ESV? No. In fact, you won't find that in the Nesyalin 28th edition or the UBS 5th. None of them noted that. You can look it up in accordance, and you can read the P45 module, and it's not there. But I have yet to find. I didn't check CNTTS. I bet CNTTS has it. But I didn't pull it up to look at it. But can an English translation provide an exhaustive textual database to you? No, it would be four volumes long, and or if it was one volume, it'd be huge. But the information's there, and if the average Christian is just reading the book, they're going to go, oh, this is interesting. There seems to be some variations here. They're going to see that. You don't see that with the Quran. You're not aware of these things. And so it does seem to me that your average Christian has access to more knowledge about the background of his text than the average Muslim does. And that's why this stuff can get as far as it goes.
Muhammad Ali says, no copy differing even in a diacritical point is met with. A manuscript with the slightest variation in text is unknown. And finally, Al-Hajjah Jijola decided to borrow from Jesus' words. He says, the Quran is fully preserved and not a jot or tittle has been changed or left out. So these are the kinds of typical claims that you'll often find people making, but there's one thing wrong with them, they're not true. If you go to this bookshop in Jordan, which I've been to in Amman, you'll be able to see 24 different versions of the Arabic Quran. I'll put the English terms up there. You can order them online, and they'll be here within a couple of days. Or you could go to Lebanon, and again, there are 13 different Arabic versions.
Is there something weird about a website called EasyQuranStore.com? I don't know. It's just, easybible store. I don't know. I guess it's all right. It's just, I don't know. It just struck me as rather strange. I don't know. That's what they call it, Joel Osteen's place. Yeah, I don't think Joel has any. Has Easy Bible? Yeah, I don't think they have any Qurans there yet. Give them time.
The Quran that you can buy. These are not English translations. These are Arabic versions. But if you want to save yourself your airfare, you can just come to my table and have a look at my little collection of 17 versions that I've collected. As I've travelled and lived in Muslim countries, gone to Islamic bookshops and said, what versions of the Quran do you have? So how did so many Arabic versions arise? Where did that come from? Well, they didn't come from Muhammad. We have to go back to his time. Muhammad never wrote a Quran, and he never sanctioned a full written version of the Quran. There's two reasons for this. Firstly, he couldn't read or write, so he was illiterate. And secondly, he could have received a revelation right up until the moment that he died. So the Quran, in effect, couldn't be completed until he'd breathed his last breath. And as a result, his followers had to wait until he died in 632 to compile a full Quran. There were some verses written on stones and leaves and camel bones. There's one there, Surat al-Fatiha. And many people memorized some of these verses. But after his death, many of his followers who'd memorized parts of the Quran, or the whole of the Quran, they were called Huffaz, were killed in a battle in Yamana in December 632. And there was a fear that the Quran might be lost. And so the caliph, Muhammad's successor, Abu Bakr, ordered that a Quran be written down in full. And he got Zayd bin Thabit to go around and collect the parts that he could find, get them from people, and write them on a scroll. And this copy was given to Hafsa, to one of Muhammad's wives. But he wasn't the only person who was collecting copies of the Quran. In the Hadith, Sahih al-Bukhari says the Quran was collected in the lifetime of the Prophet by four men, and it names them, Ubay ibn Ka'b, Mu'adh bin Jabal, Abu Zayd, and Zayd bin Thabit. And Muhammad had told his followers, there are four men that you should learn the Quran from. And he named them Abdullah ibn Mas'ud, Salim, Mu'adh, and Ubay bin Ka'b.
Now, we need to note that because, as he's going to note here in a few moments, the primary source of information concerning variants in the consonantal text, not in vowel pointing. Vowel pointing is highly interpretational, as he's going to point out here in a moment. But the primary source, from my reading, in the early Tafsir literature, of variants from the Uthmanic official version, come from a man that is mentioned right there in that second hadith, Abdullah ibn Mas'ud. And his readings constitute the majority of the variants that are noted by the early Tafsir literature. Ubay ibn Ka'b, another very important one as well. So very important to keep these things in mind when we're talking about a controlled text, and we're talking about a text that is controlled by governmental authority. You don't have a freely distributed text here. Then anyone who could control the text at a period of time, very important. Very, very important. One of the fundamental differences in how the New Testament and the Quran were transmitted, free transmission versus controlled transmission. Been over this before, but just mentioning it again.
There's also some of the same people who were collecting the Quran in the lifetime of the Prophet.
Now, you see, I mentioned something. I just happened now to look down at the channel, and Garrett the Geek confirmed for me that CNTTS lists Tetagmenoi in brackets in P45. So there you go. I've got CNTTS, and I just, like I said, just didn't bring it up. That would be, as far as I know, that would be the only currently digitized textual resource that would probably contain that information, because not in NA28. I'm 99% certain that it's not in, get that out of the way. If you don't mind, I'm just going to look real quick here, because now that I mentioned it, Acts 13:48, New Testament textual. I wish that link would work better than it does. Acts 13:48. And, UBS 5, which does have a variant at X 1348, does not include that information at all, which I would expect. If you didn't, if you weren't looking at, let's see here, CNTTS apparatus, there it is. And X 1348. I'm not giving it to you. It's the text is so small that you wouldn't be able to see it, honestly. But I'm just looking for Tetagmenoi. Why am I not seeing P45 here? I'm doing some nice musical interludes here. I'll have to look that up a little bit more. But CNTTS would be the primary source for that. For those of you who are looking at early Christmas lists for your wives or something like that, to put on your Christmas list, the CNTTS apparatus or something along those lines. Let's get back to our thing here. We're running out of time.
But there was a problem. It was a big problem that they did not agree on what the Quran should be. Abdullah ibn Mas'ud would not accept the final two surahs or chapters of the Quran, and he wouldn't accept Al-Fatiha, the first chapter. He said that was just a prayer that Muhammad prayed. He said, do not mix up with the Quran that which is not in the Quran. These two surahs are not included in the Quran. So he, being one of the people that Muhammad had said, learn the Quran from this man, had a version which only had 111 surahs, whereas the current Quran has 114 surahs. One of the other men, or two of the other men, Abu Musa, one of the four recommended by Muhammad, included two extra surahs that are not in today's Quran. We still have copies of these, and if you read them, they read very much like Quranic chapters. They were called Surat al-Khala and Surat al-Hafth, also known as Surat al-Qanud. So that made his Quran had 116 chapters or surahs. Another man, Ubay ibn Ka'b, combined two of the chapters together, making 115 chapters. And so within 20 years of Muhammad's death, four major collections of the Quran were being accepted in different cities. And you can see them. These, again, some of the men that Muhammad said learned the Quran from these men. And they had differing numbers of chapters, things that they accepted, things that they included, things that they left out. And there were about another 12 other versions that were also floating around at this time. As Islam continued to spread throughout the world, this then became a problem. As Muslim troops were gathering on the border of Armenia to invade it, Muslim troops came from all over the parts of the Muslim world. And they were in a mosque in near Armenia and reciting different versions. And they said, those who follow Abdullah ibn Mas'ud's version go there. Those who follow Abu Musa go there. And they were reciting the same chapters, but they were reciting different things. And a bit of a dispute rose up about which one was the correct version. And so this man named Hudhayfa went and complained to the caliph, Uthman. He said, we need to have only one version. And so Uthman ordered a committee of four men, include one of them being Zayd bin Thabit, to compile an authorized Quran. And he said, gather up all the other bits that you can find and burn them. Not all of the copies were destroyed. Some of the people hid theirs. They were told to hide it so they couldn't be destroyed because they believed they were authentic. People rewrote the verses after the first copies came out, and so multiple copies continued to circulate. Unfortunately, we don't have any original copy of the Quran from this period. German scholar and Muslim convert, Professor Anne-Marie Schimmel, says that no original Quranic text has survived. And
now, I did want to mention this. How many times have I heard Muslim apologists quote a Christian source that says we do not have the original manuscripts of the Bible, which, of course, we don't. I mean, it's not even a it's a given, and yet it's quoted in a context, so it's given a spin that's supposed to mean something to us. See, but here you have Muslim scholars saying no original Quranic text has survived. Now, I do know some Muslims who actually do feel that we have some Uthmanic manuscripts. I doubt that's the case, but it wouldn't be one of those specific ones that were produced at a particular time period. But here you have, you know, I wonder if the Muslims who quote Christians saying we don't have any original manuscripts will quote these citations. If not, why not? What's good for the goose is good for the gander. Again, simple matter of consistency, got to do it.
Professor Tayyar Altikulak, who's a Turkish scholar, speaks of the first mushafs, or the first codices or collections of the Quran, having been destroyed or disappeared due to wars and natural disasters. And he calls this one of the greatest weaknesses and pains of the Islamic world. But that we have copies of early manuscripts, not the originals, but some very early manuscripts. And you can go and travel around and see these in Istanbul. There's a couple there. The Cairo one in Sana'a, big collection. I'll talk about that later. Istanbul and Tashkent have a version there. The National Library in France has some. Birmingham has some. They're scattered around. These are probably the 10 most ancient ones, but they're not the same. You can look at those. In fact, we have facsimiles of these early collections here. My student Dennis can show you those, and you can compare them and see some of the difference that exists right from the earliest days. Some of those problems, you find words being inserted into the text. This is one copy from the French National Library. And you can see there the brown writing, but in the midst of it is a little black word called bimithlihi, which is similarly. That wasn't in the original, but at a later stage, someone put that in so it would conform with the standard text that's accepted today. Abdullah ibn Mas'ud's and Ubay bin Ka'b's versions did not have that word in there. It was added in later on. See that there. In the Topkapi manuscript, you can see, again, a phrase that's been added in there. That it says, Allah yakhlaqu ma yasha. So God creates what he wills. Again, that wasn't in the earlier text, but it was added in later on. So these are some of the earliest ones that we have.
Now, by the way, that is a theologically significant variant. That's not just, it's all the same stuff. It doesn't really matter. You know, you're just moving some words around, but it all has the same meaning. That's a theologically significant variant. And the question becomes, again, when you have free transmission of a text, we understand where variants come from, and you can correct them because of the multifocality of the number of manuscripts. You've got controlled manuscripts. Then the question becomes much more, why is there a change here? Because the variants are being controlled. It's not just a scribe went, oops, but controlled texts mean edited texts, or at least raise a much greater probability or possibility of edited texts. And that's one of the major, major issues we must keep in mind. I wasn't going to play all this stuff. I wanted to get to the Muslims' comments and respond to some of the things he said. We'll keep it there. I just thought this was just such a well-done presentation. Now, again, if the Muslim had gotten up and said, hey, you know what? We've known all about these things for a long, long time, and my Muslim brothers and sisters need to recognize and need to understand that our text has a history, then it would have been a completely different debate. But unfortunately, that's normally not what you end up hearing and experiencing in the conversation that takes place between Muslims and Christians. That's where it needs to be. There needs to be an acknowledgement on the part of Muslims. It's this way because of this. It's this way because our text has a history. But unfortunately, a lot of times the Muslim-Christian dialogue doesn't get exactly where it needs to go there. So hopefully you found some of that useful. Tomorrow, my presentation at ReformCon will be on hyper-Calvinism. On Friday, doing a breakout session, and that will be on that OPC document that I mentioned from 1948? I think it was 1948, 49, somewhere around there. And I think the Q&A with John Sampson and I think is tomorrow as well. I think. You can look it up, and it'll be live streamed, and so hopefully you'll find it to be. Scott Oliphant is speaking on the subject of Revelation, which should be really fascinating. So at the very least, there should probably be some very interesting folks in attendance as well. So well worth your time to check it out. Lord willing, we'll be back next week on our regular schedule on Tuesday, whatever the regular schedule is. Normally it's Tuesday, Thursday, but we'll see how that works out. Thanks for listening, watching, whatever it is you did. We'll see you next time. God bless.